Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I'll be your host for this program. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone from the literary world. My guest today is Jay Rankin. Jay has just published a very personal and very evocative book about his time as a Las Vegas resident and employee of the MGM Grand. I think it is fair to say that once you pierce through the glitz and glamour that is the facade of Vegas, there lays a rather seamy underbelly. Jay, it is great to talk to you again. Welcome
Hello,
to the
Simon.
Program.
Thank you, Simon, so much, and thank you for having me on.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. In fact, one of the reasons I became a book reviewer was I would read a book and always have questions. And being a reviewer allows me access to the author, and I can ask those questions.
Yes, you can. Fire away.
Maybe we could start with a little background information. Who is Jay Rankin?
Well, I guess I'm not clear what the answer is to that question yet. I think I still have a ways to go. I've done so many things in my life, from studying psychology, getting my master's degree in family counseling. I've been a probation officer. As a matter of fact, in my younger days when I did that, I actually had put together a manuscript that I wanted published on juvenile gangs. And, of course, it didn't get published. I knew nothing about the business. But it was used for a movie studio on gangs way back in those days. I've also been involved in real estate, built a lot of homes, which is how I eventually got to Las Vegas. As a matter of fact, my biological father had moved to Las Vegas when I was very, very young, so I had a little bit of an experience with the town even as a youngster.
I have to say that I read a lot of books, way too many. I guess I could be viewed an addict. And I can smell a bestseller in Under the Neon Sky. Without giving away any spoilers, because this really is a story that people need to discover and understand for themselves, can you give us a thumbnail sketch of the book?
Well, I worked for the MGM Grand from 7 p.m. to 3 a.m. in the morning, and I did this for 6 years. And I believe that working for a hotel in Las Vegas is different than working for a hotel in any other city in the country. The experience of the guests and the tourists is totally different in Las Vegas. And because the hotels are now corporate and they're no longer run by individuals for the most part or the mob, when properties become corporate, what that means is that there's a bottom line. You have to answer to shareholders. And that puts employees in direct conflict with very often the type of guests that they're dealing with in a 24/7 town. There are no weekends in Las Vegas. A weekend could be a Monday and a Tuesday. And the types of guests that you get in Las Vegas very often are people that have stayed up all night and been drinking and gambling and for the most part losing their money. So it's a very different type of a job working for a hotel in Vegas than it is anywhere else. So that background being laid, my experiences working in Las Vegas in the middle of the night, needless to say, were quite unique, very unique. And Under the Neon Sky is a very truthful story through my eyes, and it takes the reader on a journey of what it was like for me working in the middle of the night on the Strip. As a matter of fact, on my website, which is www.jayslasvegas.com, my first chapter is a free download, and that first chapter drops you right in the middle of what ensued when Mike Tyson bit Evander Holyfield's ear on that famous fight night and the chaos that followed when that fight ended. And that first chapter is a free download on my website. But it will give the reader an overall general view, eye-opening, I must say, as to what it is like on the other side of the fence, what goes on behind the scenes and behind the all the glitter and behind those neon lights.
As a reviewer, I have a theory about books in general, and that is you've got to get the hook in early. If you haven't hooked the reader by, oh, let's say page 20, you're going to lose them. You get the hook in really, really early. I mean, everyone's heard about the ear-biting incident. And I mean, what better way to kick off an expose of Vegas?
Well, that was probably, like I had suggested, the most profound experience I had had in all of my time, of all my experiences. That night was, on a scale of 1 to 10, a 10, hands down for me. It was something that, for me, not only shook me to my core, but it was like a backdrop. It was surreal of what ensued after that fight. And that's what that chapter does talk about. And even I myself sometimes reading that first or second page, I have to keep reading, and I'm the one that wrote the story. So, but it does bring back all those memories, and thank you for that. It is quite a an event that took place that night.
I had assumed that Under the Neon Sky was your first excursion into writing, but you mentioned earlier that you had a piece that was turned into something on TV about gangs.
No, at the time, back in the very early 80s, when I was a probation officer, I had written about gangs. The subject fascinated me, and in those days, gangs were growing throughout the country in all major cities, and working in a detention camp, I learned a great deal about this subculture, and I could see that it was not something that was going to go away and that it was going to get worse. And sure enough, it had, and those kids had their own language as well, and I wrote about it, and it was a pretty factual little manuscript. And at the time, they were making movies about gangs. Colors was one of them, I believe. Robert Duvall starred in it, and there were several other films that came out that dealt with gangs, juvenile gangs. And my little manuscript was used by the people that were doing research for the film, and they actually stole it from me. So it never got published, and I was never hired, but the material was used. So that was my first experience in the book industry.
Right, and a truly wonderful experience, I'm sure.
Oh, it was. I got to write something, and to me that was, wow, somebody's actually going to use what I wrote, so even if I didn't get paid for it, so.
Right. Well, you can't have everything.
No, of course not, especially in the book business.
Right. I have to admit that I'm one of those rare reviewers that does actually read a book cover to cover. You can test me on it if you want. It must have taken quite a bit of soul searching to write it. Was there a defining moment, a point where you said, "I have to commit this to paper"?
Yes, there was. It was actually, they say that if you work and live in Las Vegas, sooner or later, everyone you know is going to come to visit you. And I actually came home from work one night. You have to remember that as a doorman, if you've ever been to Vegas or any hotel that has a doorman, there's a uniform that they wear. And certainly I had to wear that uniform, and I believe
the safari suit?
Well, that was the summer uniform, the pith helmet and the tassels on the long socks, and I looked like a Bermuda street cop with the whistle around my neck. And I came home at 2 in the morning, and I had some friends visiting, and they were staying, and I walked in the door, and they couldn't believe what I looked like. They had never seen me in such a getup. And we sat and we talked, and one of them said, "You know, Jay, listening to you telling us stories about your experience there, you need to take notes. You need to start writing this down." And the seed germinated in my head within just a few short days, and in fact, I did start taking notes. And I took notes for approximately 5 years. And that's really how the whole thing started. The notes themselves started taking on a life of its own. And I could see that, in fact, not just from what was happening to me at the hotel, but what was happening in my personal life, in my own relationships, also had a great deal to do with Las Vegas. And I could see where this was, in fact, an important story that needed to be written.
Like I said earlier, I smell bestseller. As I understand it, you've been pretty busy doing interviews. In fact, you were in Vegas over the weekend. How did that go?
It went well. I think that when you think about Las Vegas stories, you think in terms of films and books like Fear and Loathing and Casino and the handful of other, even the series on television, Vegas. My story seems to have found a niche. It seems to come at it from a little bit of a different angle without all the glitz and glitter. And I did get an interview on their local ABC affiliate station, and they wanted me on, so I went ahead and went on. And in fact, the questions that were asked of me related much more to the being the soldier on the street, the worker bee in the field, since I was not considered management working for a hotel in Vegas, and what that was like dealing with the public and the guests and the tourists and the conventions and the people that came for specific entertainment, whether it was a fight night for boxing or the Rolling Stones, and how all of these events bring such a vast and different array of people and cultures from all over the world, and what that was like. And that I think is what a lot of people, whether I'm being interviewed on radio or television, really want to know about. That seems to fascinate people more than my story being something that's fictional, or a how-to story in nonfiction, because I believe my book does read like a novel, although it is nonfiction.
Have any of your friends in Vegas read the book?
Yes, they have. And interestingly and quite honestly, I think that it made them nervous. It scared them a little bit. Job security in Las Vegas is not particularly high. You basically, whatever you see and hear, you're supposed to keep your mouth shut and stay out of it. And my book does tell a few secrets. It does tell a few eye-opening events of what actually happened through my eyes. And my friends that still work for the hotels in Las Vegas became quite nervous about that. And even though I know they've read the story, a lot of them are at this point staying away from me a little bit. And I can certainly understand why. I really can. And I think that once the dust settles, I'll continue my relationship with them. But for right now, some of the people that I know, as good of friends as they are, staying away. And I understand. I really do.
You're a bit of a leper.
Well, I'm not management. I'm not. I didn't come from that perspective. So, I am a little bit of a leper right now. So,
okay. Well, let's move on to a little bit of shameless marketing. I know you mentioned your website earlier, but can you give it again, and what's the best place that people can buy copies of Under the Neon Sky?
They can get Under the Neon Sky by doing one of several things. My website is www.jayslasvegas.com, and there on the site are links to Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Or you can go directly to Amazon and Barnes & Noble and type in Under the Neon Sky, a Las Vegas doorman story, type in my name, and it'll bring you the link right to the page. So you can purchase the book either way by going to my website, jayslasvegas.com, or directly to Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and purchase the book. And the advantage to my website is only that you'll be able to read that first chapter for free and to see if it's something that you'd like. So there you have it.
And I can guarantee if you read the first chapter, you're going to go, oh, yeah, I got to read this book. I just got to.
Well, thank you, Simon. Now, I believe it's an interesting book. I think that a lot of people that do like Las Vegas are going to definitely see themselves in this story. And they may even get a little bit of a different perspective on themselves as they read it. They really will. So I tried to cover the gamut. So
I spent some time in Vegas in the mid-90s. Every year I'd make the trek from San Diego to Vegas in my little Toyota company truck. I went to Comdex. That was the hook. And I'd tell my boss, who was the owner of the company, I was going for a week, but I'd leave after 2 days. I just couldn't handle the insanity of the whole place. You know, that there was nothing real. And I certainly could not envisage living in the city. You know, sure, it's billed as a family-friendly place to visit, but that very much is a facade. How difficult is it to actually live there and not become consumed by what's going on?
Believe it or not, most people that live and work in Las Vegas, especially those that work in the hotel industry, don't like the Strip. They don't want to go to the Strip. They've been there all week. They've dealt with the conventions, the tourism, and the congestion, and all of that, and they pretty much want to stay away. But it doesn't mean that there aren't other caveats to living in Las Vegas. There are what they call pubs and local casinos everywhere, all over the city. And in terms of gambling, slot machines, you'll find them in all of your gas stations, and you'll find them in all of your markets to go shopping. So There are reminders everywhere, and certainly living in Las Vegas, you need to be a little bit careful because it's a 24/7 town. you can get just as much accomplished in the middle of the night as you can during the day, whether it's washing your car, going to the cleaners, going to the market. Everything is always open. And when you have a family, this is something that you need to keep in perspective. If you own a business, it's something you need to keep in perspective, because living and working in Las Vegas does have that temptation, the temptation of sex, the temptation of gambling, the temptation of drinking. And it's a challenge, and you do need to live your life like a normal, everyday American family and stay away from some of these elements. Now, on the other side of the coin, Las Vegas does present a wide array of entertainment. It's probably, per square mile, the most entertainment other than possibly Nashville, Branson, Missouri, is another place where there's just rows and rows of entertainment, and certainly in Vegas, the best entertainment in the world is there. So you can also have a great time living there. The town experienced explosive growth. The neighborhoods are beautiful. The schools are brand new. It's not an expensive place to live. So there's no state tax, corporate tax. So there's a lot of advantages to working in Las Vegas. There is a lot of need for business, and I think that when the recession ends, Vegas is going to come back like all the other cities across this country. But there are some things to be aware of if you decide to live there. So I don't know if I've answered that question, but I lived in Las Vegas, and where I lived had nothing to do with gaming or staying up all night or anything like that. It was a great little neighborhood, and as long as I stayed in that neighborhood and took in the positive things that Vegas offered, everything was absolutely fine. And I think that people are seeing that more and more, where Las Vegas does not equate to gambling and Sin City and drinking and staying up all night. It's a wonderful retirement community. So there's good and bad, I guess, like any town.
Of course. I guess I was not the typical tourist. I took some time to explore the city. Now this was more than a decade ago, so you know, I'm sure things have changed, but I actually saw three very, very distinctive environments: the Strip, downtown, and the suburbs, the outskirts. The Strip was for the well-heeled tourists. Downtown was for the less affluent tourists, and also the indigent population, beggars and scary hookers on every street corner. And the outskirts, that was where the residents went. Is that true today?
Absolutely not. Las Vegas is known to reinvent itself, and in 10 years, it's probably reinvented itself twice. If you go downtown now, there's a show that takes place outside. Fremont Street is now closed off. It's only foot traffic only, and they did a beautiful job. There's a dome overhead that shows all kinds of different themed shows. Everything has been cleaned up. You won't see those street hookers any longer. You won't see those bums sitting on the sidewalk begging for money. They've really cleaned it up. And downtown has become as much of a tourist attraction as the Strip. Many tourists that come in, part of their agenda is to go downtown with their kids and walk Fremont Street, and it's a wonderful experience. It really is. It's not at all like it used to be, so they did a great job. Certainly the Strip redefined itself with their mega resorts, and now for the second time, the newest mega resort, which is City Center, is an unbelievable spectacle just visually to look at. The MGM Corporation has taken the term mega resort to a whole new level, and I believe Steve Wynn as well. His target was adults, and he built a beautiful hotel that caters to adults. Another target in Las Vegas is the 20-something, the younger crowd, and you've now got the Hard Rock, which caters, and Planet Hollywood, which caters to them. The family resort target has redefined itself with the Excalibur and possibly Mandalay Bay. The MGM as well caters to lots of families. So I think that Las Vegas has matured and evolved. It's not like it used to be at all, Simon. It's really gotten its act together. Certainly the recession has hurt a lot of people, a lot of families. Vegas is very down in their stock and in their revenue. And they've tightened up their belts a lot, but no, it's not like it was 10 years ago at all.
In your book, you paint the picture of the wide-eyed, smiling guest as he or she arrives on a Friday, and the sleep-deprived, broke, bitter, and twisted guest leaving on a Sunday evening. Was that the norm?
Well, I'd like to segue into that. I think that Las Vegas was built on promises, the promises of possibilities. Maybe you can win money. Maybe you can get lucky with a woman. Maybe you can eat the best food in the world. You could even spark your existing relationship. It can be a very romantic town. And all of these things happen under the backdrop of lights and entertainment. And it happens in a place of few boundaries. There are no real boundaries. And it's all of this overabundance. And I also believe that for a lot of people, a casino itself is a place for many to feel very free and to be happy and to forget about their lives for a moment in time. And then here I was. I was someone who could open just about any door in town. And in fact, I did help lots and lots of people have a good time. All you needed was some money and some charm. And then I saw a lot of drama, some tragedy, and lots of funny stuff. And I don't want you to get me wrong. I help people, and I think most people did, in fact, have a great time in Las Vegas, while others burned themselves out, and while others, still others, became brain dead. And I think for some of these people, one of the best parts of the trip was the anticipation of coming to Las Vegas, that excitement. Certainly standing in your hotel room and looking out your window at the Strip with all of its offerings and choices. And I also believe that with a lot of people, once their feet hit Vegas soil, something happened. The brain sort of went into this Michiganess state of mind where all the wires immediately began to burn and spark and smoke until eventually a short occurred in the lobe where the survival area of the brain is located. And I saw people begin to do things that they would never do anywhere else at any other time in their life. They would go nuts. Once a man asked me for a cab to Caesars, and he got in, closed the door, and left. And the next woman in line was a woman looking down in her purse, and she looked up, and she said, "Where's my husband? That was my husband." And she was wearing a tight skirt, and she wobbled down the street after the cab, chasing her husband, and the poor thing. And the odd thing was that the cab never stopped. This man, I think, forgot that he had his wife with him. And this is what Vegas does. The cab just disappeared into the Vegas night. There was another time where a man was so drunk he handed me a tip for getting him a limo, and it was a $5,000 tip. Luckily, he was a guest of the hotel, and I found him, and I returned it. I seen people, when it's 115 degrees outside, take off their shirts, buy an ice cream cone for one hand and a beer for the other, and walk the Strip in a pair of thongs. People hurt themselves in Las Vegas. How many stay up all night, two nights in a row, drink alcohol, lose all their money? They don't eat anything, and by the time the weekend is over, they look like they need an oxygen tent. How many people cross these lines in Las Vegas doing things they really shouldn't do? It's great to party hard, and I can help them do that, but it's something else to hurt themselves, like gambling three or four times more than their budget allows, not spending time with their spouse, not doing things together with their spouse, certainly not showering, not going to bed. I've seen those people on that Friday night get out of the cab. Their shirts are white and pressed, and the jewelry and the hair and the glow in the eyes, and holding hands. And I've seen those same people on a Sunday afternoon with all the effects of dehydration, the cracked lips, the slits for eyes that are blood red, and that look that I've seen so many times between people of rage and hatred. And they're just absolutely miserable. The lunch money for their child for the year is gone. And at this point, you know, they look like they hate each other. And this is what I used to see a lot of in Las Vegas. But the interesting part is when you talk to people that went through that, that drank all night, threw up, lost all their money, some of them might have even had an affair with a hooker. And thought they fell in love until the hooker had to leave because she had another client. And you asked them, how was your trip in Vegas? They had a great time. I call that the grand illusion, the absolute grand illusion. And I do believe that there is something that chemically takes place in the brain with a lot of people that go to Vegas. And they do cross those boundaries and do cross those lines and end up hurting themselves in the end, and I write about that.
In my opinion, and obviously I don't have your brain, don't have your memories, but it would have been easy to add some lifestyles of the rich and famous vignettes, but you didn't do that. You basically steered clear of the celebrities.
You know, Simon, my feeling about the celebrities, and I met so many, I've lost count. And my feeling about that was that, number one, I wasn't in a great position to interact with a lot of the celebrities. Not that I didn't have interactions, I certainly did. But for the most part, it wasn't my intention to collect celebrity stories. I think there's more than enough that's written about that, and that was never my state of mind. It was not in my consciousness to find a celebrity story and to write about it. It wasn't who I was. Who I was someone who was caught between management and the guest. I was the one that very often the guests took their rage and their frustration and their exhaustion out on me. And I've had cigarettes flicked at me, drinks thrown in my face. And I could see that there was such an interesting experience to be had with people that come and see and visit Las Vegas, both good and bad. And that was my focus. That's what I wanted to write about. Plus, I had had experiences living in Las Vegas in my personal life as well, and I needed to include that into my story as well. So even though I've had interactions with celebrities, many of whom were famous athletes, it was not something that I chose to write about.
I actually admire you for making that decision. I think it's a far better book because you talk about your experience, not relating nasty stories about people that we see on the TV every day.
Correct. I think that, I don't know, maybe I'd sell more copies if Under the Neon Sky were geared more toward the National Enquirer, but that wasn't who I was, and I needed to stay true to myself in writing this story.
Mm-hmm. National Enquirer, that's a whole different program.
Yeah, but it's also, I think, the number one selling paper in the country, if that's what I heard is correct.
Tabloid, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to change track just a little bit.
Sure.
The drug problem is everywhere. I live in a small town in Mississippi, a place that no one has ever heard of. Something like 20,000 people live here, and there's a church on every street corner. In fact, we're even in a dry county. My wife conned me. You know, she assured me that booze was readily available. It wasn't until we got down here that I discovered she was lying. Anyway,
I'm sorry, Simon.
Anyway, a few months ago, I was at my local gas station stroke convenience store, but they actually should rename it Cheers. I mean, everyone knows everyone. You know, the owner of the gas station says, "Hi, Simon," when I see him, you know, and we chat about nothing in particular. A young man came in to the store and asked if they sold roses. Not the flower kind, the mesh screen kind that's used in smoking crack. I mean, I was floored. You know, if drugs are here in Picayune, I mean, what's it like in Vegas? Is Vegas any worse than any other city?
You know, I don't know the answer. It's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that. But I will venture out to say that drug usage is probably as big in Vegas as it is in any other city, because a lot of guests come and they're not just drinking, they're blowing steam. They're getting high as well. Certainly Las Vegas has its share of drugs and drug problems like any other city. Whether it's worse, I'm not sure. I really don't know. I think that people that were taking drugs and on drugs was something that I had to deal with, because it made things even more unpredictable. But you need to remember something about Las Vegas. Although there are areas in Las Vegas away from the Strip that are certainly having drug problems, it's not unlike any other city in the country, except for one thing. In Las Vegas, you have events and you have conventions. And you need to understand that what that means is that the population of your tourism is going to change dramatically. So if you've got the National Finals Rodeo coming for a couple weeks, and then right on the heels of that comes the Magic Show, and then on the heels of that comes the jewelry convention, and then on the heels of that there's a fight, and then on the heels of that the Rolling Stones come in. What you're finding, and this isn't just for me, it's for the hotels, the restaurants, for example, Valentine's Day, the city changes dramatically from month to month, depending on who's there. And some of these events bring in a crowd where there's an awful lot of drugs involved with that particular group. A fight night, some of the concerts, certainly. But I would say, other than that, certainly as a doorman, whether I was a doorman at a big hotel in New York City, or I'm a doorman in a big hotel in Las Vegas, you're going to have problems with people with drugs. But yes, drugs are everywhere in Las Vegas. If you want it, it's there. It's there for the taking. Is it a bigger problem there than New York City, Los Angeles, Detroit? I'm not sure. I really don't know the answer to that. Is it a more dangerous situation for me as a doorman to be dealing with somebody angry that's on drugs? Of course. Absolutely it is. Just like it's more dangerous if somebody's on alcohol, and I have to assess that. I was assessing people all the time. I wrote about it in the book where I looked at people. First of all, people that were on drugs or drinking, I could see it within a split second. And I assessed them. How dangerous were they? How out of control is this? And what I needed to do. So I'm not sure I answered your question. Thoroughly, but certainly drugs and alcohol were a huge part of my job. Huge.
Right.
It wasn't how many people are fresh and their bodies are clean of all drugs and alcohol. The question is how many people weren't like that.
Right.
So
I know I should not have been surprised. Office politics are the standard everywhere you go. Doesn't matter if it's big company, small company. I'm sure that even being Mickey Mouse at Disney World, you know, has its politics involved in it. Your book goes into some of the politics. Should management have been involved more? Should they have taken more notice of what was going on?
Oh, you know, I see hotel politics in Las Vegas as, at this point now, especially since I'm away from it, as it is what it is. I mean, I think at some point in life, when there's a conflict in your life, a part of you needs to, instead of always trying to put out the fire or always trying to make yourself right, you say it is what it is, and you move on accordingly. I think that there are some inherent problems working for hotels in Las Vegas and dealing with management as someone who especially was in my position. But whether you're a bartender or a dealer or housekeeping or a bellman or valet or a doorman, I think we all needed to steer clear of any conflicts with management. You wanted to keep them as your friend. It was kind of like knowing people. as the terminology, which is, I've got some friends in management, because those are get-out-of-jail-free cards. They really are. Management in Las Vegas is being told by upper-level management, who's being told by executive-level management, how things need to be run. So by the time it trickles down, especially if there's a problem, the manager on the bottom is going to really let somebody have it. And that's usually the grunts that are actually doing the work. And this is something that the grunts need to be very careful with and just simply say, yes, sir, no, sir, and be nice as can be and hope that a guest of the hotel doesn't write something to the hotel that's negative. It's in some ways a very scary place to work. You are working, here's the bottom line, you are working in a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week town with no boundaries, where you can drink as much alcohol at 3 a.m. as you can at 1 in the afternoon, where you can lose as much money during those hours. There are no rules. There are no boundaries. There are no clocks on the wall. And guests become very unpredictable. This is in direct correlation to management. Management wants to make sure that you as an employee are going to treat all these guests as nicely as you can, because the executive management is saying, I want these people to come back. I want them to call our hotel home. I don't want to hear of any problems. I don't want to have any letters written about any of our employees. I want everyone to treat everybody with grand class 5-star service. And that's really the bottom line, Simon, that lower level management are people that are always covering themselves at all times. Those are the people that are really closest to what's going on with the grunts and closest to the guests. It's not middle management, and it certainly isn't executive level management. Those are the people that are looking at the bottom lines. Those are the people that are answering to the shareholders. Those are the ones that are trying to make sure that the hotel has a 98-99% hotel occupancy. And you look at the quarterly revenue, and that's what tells the whole story. And you need to also understand that revenue for a hotel is no longer just gaming. It's rooms. I think it's 50-60% are rooms, restaurants, the food, the souvenirs, all of those extra things, the shows, are now big-time revenue for hotels. It's not
right,
like
and
the old days.
Yeah, in the old days, they were throwaways.
They were. Those were the things that made people feel special, where a bellman, a pit boss, a host would walk up to you and say, we're watching what you're playing. Listen, dinner's on me tonight. How many people are in your party? Your hotel room is on me tonight. We have a wonderful breakfast. It's on me. I'm going to write you a ticket for 10 free drinks. It's on me. And it made you feel important. It made you feel special. Today, you want comps? They'll actually print out a computer readout of how much you need to play in order to get comp for a room or a flight or a meal. So everything is bottom line, bottom line, bottom line. And as a hotel employee, you need to really have as good of a relationship with management as you possibly can. If you don't, you are going to go to work every day fearful of your job. And there's no worse experience than that, than being afraid each day you go to work if your job is still there.
Okay, I'm being whined at in my ear by my producer. We of course, have overran the amount of time allotted.
Oh, gosh, Simon,
but,
you sure have.
Yeah, but, I mean, that's what I do.
Well, Simon, I want to thank you so much for having me on and giving me this opportunity.
Oh, absolutely, my pleasure. But one last question. Is there another book in the works?
Well, there is, and I'm writing things all the time, and there's three more projects. One of them is going to be about the doorman and what happened to me after I left Las Vegas. And the second project is about another Las Vegas story, staying there. And the third one, they seem to tell me that there's a real need for Vegas for Dummies. I think there's already a book called that that's not very well updated, and I'm working on that as well. So hopefully you'll be hearing from me after Under the Neon Sky runs its course.
Well, I'm pretty certain that we're going to be seeing Under the Neon Sky on the New York Times bestseller list.
Oh, from your lips. to the big man's ears. Thank you, Simon, so much.
It has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. And I'm sure I speak for everyone here at Blogger News in wishing you every success with Under the Neon Sky. And I do hope that you'll keep in touch, because I want to read your next one.
Simon, thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay, this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a great day. And again, I want to thank Jay Rankin for taking time out to talk to us. We will be back on the air again soon. Goodbye.